Hello and welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and I really have been enjoying doing these history podcasts with Jimmy Akin, so we get an opportunity to do another one today. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of many books, including two brand new 20 Answers books, one on Protestantism and one on the New Testament. But you can find all of Jimmy's books on our website at shop.catholic.com. He's also the podcaster behind Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and a man to whom apparently the ancient world is endlessly fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
You haven't got tired of it yet, have
you?
No,
I want to learn lots more.
So,
it's like, where am I going to find the time to read all the stuff I want about it?
Today, I want to talk to you about writing in the ancient world, because
okay.
I do not know if you know this, but most of the New Testament, perhaps all of it, is in writing.
Yes, all of the New Testament is in writing.
Oh, it's all in writing. Okay, there's no pictures.
Not in the original edition.
No, okay, not in the original edition, right. So actually knowing something about ancient writing is very...
Most of it is letters, in fact, that... You know,
oh, yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Okay, so most of the books individually, those would be letters. Yeah, a gospel is a different thing.
Right, all but five books are letters.
Oh, yeah, the Apocalypse, right?
Or no, that's a letter too.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. It's
I never thought about that.
It's a letter sent to seven churches.
Oh, yeah, okay, so the four gospels and the Acts of the Apostles.
Right.
Those are not letters.
Right.
And we'll talk about them.
You could kind of argue about, is 1 John technically a letter or not, but yeah.
Okay.
Also, you could kind of argue about Hebrews, but five certainly are not letters, and the others either are clearly or are arguably letters.
So let's talk about letters in the ancient world then.
Okay.
If you're going to have letters, you got to have somebody deliver them. Was there a post office?
No, there was not.
Okay, so how are these letters getting where they're going?
Well, it depends on who you were.
Okay.
If you were in, say, the Roman military— like you're a general or something, they had a system of military couriers, military and diplomatic couriers that you could use to send letters back and forth with Rome to get instructions and send reports and stuff. But ordinary people did not have any access to that. So then it kind of divides by social class. If you're rich, you've got slaves.
Oh, you just send a slave?
You send a slave with the letter.
That's expensive. That's more than
keeping up a slave. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And frequently you would send a literate slave who could then read the letter out loud to the person and mimic your vocal inflections, because he probably took down the letter.
It's like a voicemail kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like voicemail. And he can also supply in, because he was there when the letter was written, he probably was the scribe that wrote it. He will know more of the context of the letter. So if something's unclear in the letter, the person can ask him a question and say, well, wait, what does that mean? And he can explain.
Okay.
And then he can take their letter in reply and bring it back to you.
Okay.
So that's how you could do it if you were rich. Most vast majority of people, not rich.
Okay.
So how do they send a letter? Well, you might think they didn't, that they just didn't send letters. They totally did.
This was a big thing?
Poor people loved letters. They just absolutely loved them, even though they couldn't read. Because this is the only way. I mean, there's no Facebook. There is no telephone. Letters are the only way you have to keep in touch with your loved ones who are on a business trip or moved or in the army or something like that. And so ordinary people loved letters. And the way they would send them is they would find someone who just happened to be going where the letter needed to go.
Oh.
And so, like, if you knew your friend is going to, let's say, Thermopylae.
Yeah.
And, I've got a son in Thermopylae. Bring him this letter, please.
Yeah, right.
Or even if it's not Thermopylae, maybe he's going to Alexandria. Well, that's, it's kind of near Thermopylae. Please take this letter to Alexandria and give it to someone who can take it to Thermopylae.
Wow.
And so there was this informal network of where it might not even be the person you give the letter to that delivers it. It just finds its way through packet routing where it needs to go. And packet routing is actually the way information gets routed on the internet. When you send an email, it's divided into packets that are then routed to convenient nodes and then reassembled at its destination, but it doesn't have to take a direct route. And that's the point of the internet, because it was developed by DARPA during the Cold War as a way to have a communications grid in the event of Cold War, in the event of nuclear war. So if, like, let's say you got a big communications hub in New York,
yeah,
but New York gets taken out by a nuke, well, then the orders can route around the New York hub through packet routing and get where they need to go.
I didn't know. That's fascinating.
Yeah, that's how we got the internet. And so they had packet routing as a form of it to get letters where they needed to go in the ancient world. And this system is actually still used today in underdeveloped. It's much less common because now people have the internet, and even in developing parts of the world, people have their phones and can communicate. It's still in use in areas that are economically underdeveloped, in like some of the South Sea Islands and things like that. In parts of Southeast Asia, if you want to send a letter, you may just give it to someone who happens to be traveling in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this was a means of communication then that is actually available to most people,
yeah,
or to many people,
yeah,
in any case. So, but people couldn't read and write though.
Yeah, so you had to. What was typically done is you would hire a scribe.
Mm-hmm.
A scribe is a person who makes his money by living. It makes his living by writing, and frequently they would serve as what's called a scrivener. So, you know, you may not be, I mean, you could be Cicero and be so good at dictating letters that they have a high literary quality that will be remembered for centuries, in which case you just dictate the letter. But you may be a totally uneducated rural farmer who, you know, is kind of on towards one unfashionable end of the bell curve in terms of, you know, IQ. And so so you still want to tell your loved one that you love them and you're doing okay and you want to know how they are. But you're kind of tongue-tied.
Yeah.
And so the scribe will function as a scrivener and put your message in good words for you.
Yeah.
So there's kind of a spectrum in terms of how much an individual sending a letter determined the words, the exact words. He could insist, say, write this exactly, but you also had scribes functioning as scriveners or amanuenses, that's another term for this kind of function, where they would basically edit or even ghostwrite your letter for you. You could tell him, I want to say kind of this stuff, and then he would say it in a nice way.
So it's a different idea then of authorship than we have.
Right.
Like today, if you say, I'm the author, and if somebody wrote a few sentences of it, you'd say, well, you're not really the author. Like somebody else.
Yeah.
So, but this is a much more fluid kind of concept of authorship.
Correct. And we actually have things like this today. I mean, we do have ghostwriters today.
Yeah.
I mean, not for letters typically, but for books.
Yeah.
And we have copy editors who, even though they're not ghosting for you, they will polish your writing.
Right.
And that's actually a standard practice in the publishing industry. Almost nobody, everybody gets copywritten before a book goes out.
Yeah. Okay. So, but there is in the ancient world
a very fluid
sense of authorship.
And this explains in part why some of the New Testament letters by the same author, it's not the whole reason, but it's part of the reason why, say, Paul's letters don't all sound exactly the same, because he's using different scribes. So the scribe has some degree of input depending on what the letter author is willing to give him. And we know Paul used different scribes during the course of his career, and that has each one like colors the letter he wrote a little bit.
And but Paul is my notion of Paul has always been that he's a very highly educated man and probably quite literate, that he could have written himself.
He could have, and he did write what are called the postscripts.
Okay.
So you know how when we're finishing a letter, we'll write PS at the bottom of it and put on a little added thing that maybe we forgot.
Yeah.
Well, the PS stands for postscript, which in Latin means after the writing. So you wrote the letter and now, oh, here's this little bit from after the writing was done.
Right.
And it was customary in the ancient world to include a postscript in the hand of the author.
Mm-hmm.
they didn't sign letters the way we do. Mm-hmm. You know, you put your name at the bottom. I would sign a letter, Jimmy Akin. Right. And they didn't do that. But they would have the author write a short postscript, which does a couple of things. The first thing it does is it signifies that it authenticates the letter, which is the purpose of putting a signature at the bottom.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not to tell the person who wrote the letter. You know, they could see that on the outside of the envelope today. Right. You wouldn't want to read this whole letter. Oh, that's who wrote this down at
the
bottom.
Oh, yeah, right.
But it's to authenticate the letter, that this is my signature. This is not a forgery. No one wrote this letter and sent it on my behalf without my consent.
Right.
And so the postscript did that. And so Paul will say, we can tell where his postscripts begin. And frequently he'll say something that tells us that, like, see with what big letters I write with my own hand.
I love that part.
And it's partly because he may have had vision difficulties. We have other reasons to suppose he had vision difficulties. It may also be because he wasn't trained as a scribe, so he didn't write small the way a professional scribe would to save paper.
Right.
But he would write those, but it was customary for everybody to use a scribe, even if you were capable of writing. I mean, maybe a scribe himself wouldn't.
Uh-huh.
But ordinary people were not, even if they could read. Reading and writing are two different skills. You know how lots of people, like, let's say your doctor can read, but then you look at what he writes on a prescription pad and it's like, yeah, I'm not sure he's got the writing part down.
No. Right.
And yeah, so even though Paul absolutely could read, he wasn't trained professionally to be a careful scribe and have neat, good penmanship and small letters to save paper for your client and stuff like that.
Okay, so the letters, let's take Paul's letters then.
Okay.
Are they pretty typical of the mail of the day?
Well, in some ways, yes. They follow the standard letter format. They'll have the typical opening for a letter at the time, which is sender to recipient.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, like how we have at
get
the
that
top,
out of the way, right?
Yeah, right? At the top of an email, we'll have sender and your name and then to and whoever you're sending it to.
Right.
And they had something similar. They would say sender to recipient. So it would be Paul to the churches of Corinth,
yeah,
or something like that. And then there would be a greeting and frequently a benediction. You know, you'd wish the blessing of God or the gods on whoever you were writing to. And then there would be a postscript at the end. But other than that, Paul's letters are really, really, really different. I mean, just amazingly different. People do not realize this unless you've studied how ancient letters worked. Paul's letters are freaks of nature by ancient letter standards.
So how are they different?
In a couple of ways. One way you're going to find as soon as you get the letter in your hands, it's massive. Okay. The typical letter back then filled a page.
Okay.
And these are not big pages. So it's just a few dozen words is all a typical letter is. Even Cicero's average letter is short. And this is true actually of all of the letters in the New Testament, even the short ones like 2 John.
Yeah.
And 3 John and Jude and Philemon. Those are the four shortest. Even Cicero's average letter is shorter than Paul's shortest letter. All of Paul's letters are longer than average by ancient standards, even for a literary figure who wasn't just saying, hi, how are you? I'm fine.
No, this is Cicero.
This is Cicero, yeah. And even so Paul's letters are just massive. I did a calculation once, and I forget the exact number, but Romans is like 82 times the size of an ordinary letter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So you can just imagine, Paul has never visited Rome.
Yeah.
And then the Romans get this monster kaiju letter in the mail.
Kaiju.
And it's like, wow. So
yeah, right. Okay.
So just by the physically feeling the letter, you were going to know this is something different.
Yeah.
Also, when you open it up and you start reading it, you're going to find differences too. Like, he's got co-authors.
Oh.
He'll say things like Paul and Silvanus and Timothy to the Church of Thessalonica. When was the last time you got a letter, Cy Kellett, with co-authors?
No, never. I can't think of that. Yeah,
that does not happen. It didn't happen today. It doesn't happen today, and it didn't happen then. So this having co-authors in letters is totally unheard of. Now, the co-authors were definitely in the back seat.
Uh-huh.
These are Paul's letters, but he is allowing his co-ministers
mm-hmm.
to serve some kind of role
yeah.
in them to validate their role as his co-ministers, if nothing else, but also, you know, to get input from them as the letter was being written. That's something else that's different. In another difference from the ancient world and today is they didn't understand privacy back then.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had people around you basically all the time.
No.
Including when you were writing your letters. So these pictures you see of Paul at a writing desk by himself,
yeah.
writing a letter by himself.
Yeah.
No.
No.
He would have had a scribe.
Uh-huh.
And there would be lots of other Christians standing in the background listening.
Mm-hmm.
And there wouldn't have been a writing table because they didn't write on tables.
Mm-hmm.
What you'd do is you'd either stretch out your garment between your knees or you just write on your knee.
Oh, okay.
So we'd have a scribe with no table writing on his knee or his lap.
Okay.
But there would always be people around, and this happens even in some cultures today. I was reading a story about a missionary family. I think they were maybe in Indonesia or something.
Okay.
I think it was Indonesia, and they had household servants. You know, they employed locals. And the wife of the missionaries were from a Western country where we have high privacy expectations.
Right.
And so she would just at certain points, she would want to just go be alone. So she'd like go into the back room so she could write her own letters to people and correspond and whatever. The servants would follow her. So she wouldn't have to be alone.
Oh.
It's like being alone is a bad thing.
Uh-huh.
And so right. that's the same kind of ethic they had in Paul's world. And we can even see, we can even tell when, in one point in 1 Corinthians, Paul is talking about how he didn't baptize very many members of the Corinthian church.
Right.
And he's listing, well, I baptized this person and this person.
Oh, wait a minute.
Oh, and I also baptized the house of this guy.
Yeah, right.
And I don't know if I baptized anyone else. And the person he mentions is mentioned elsewhere in the letter as being with him at the time.
Oh, so
it's like as Paul's dictating,
hey, you also
you did me too.
Yeah, right. Don't forget.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My whole family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't so that's funny. We can see that right in the content of the letter.
Yeah.
Because it is funny when you read it. It's kind of like, I only baptized in this. Oh, yeah. I also baptized. I don't know who else I baptized.
Yeah. But one of the things that the massive size of Paul's letters show is these were, in his mind, major, major literary works. These were not letters he was just dashing off.
So,
and that's significant because you'll hear some people who don't know anything about ancient letters saying like, oh, well, Paul just wrote these letters. He didn't intend them to be scripture or big literary productions, and nobody really cared about them at first, and they only gained authority slowly over time. No. These things were freakishly huge literary productions. They would have demanded authority right from the beginning.
Right, right. So Paul
and part of the reason they would demand authority is the money that was involved, because there is no cheap paper at this time. You have to have either animal skin parchment, which is expensive because, you know, you make it out of animals.
Yeah.
Or you have papyrus, which has to be hand woven from the papyrus reed in Egypt. And so you have this each piece of writing material has to be handcrafted. So think about what that's going to do to the right. price of writing materials.
Yeah.
And then you have to have a scribe. And the scribe, typically, he's going to come to you. Now, he may have a reusable writing surface, like a piece of parchment he's going to bleach later mm-hmm. on to get the writing off of it, or a wax tablet or something. But he's going to come. He's going to take down the notes. You're going to have to pay him for that. Then he's going to go off and he's going to make a draft of the letter. And typically he's going to make two copies of it, one for you to send and one for you to keep in your own archives if you're a literary author.
Right.
And And then if you don't like what he's done and you want revisions, I mean, you may be able to like hand write a few revisions in the margins, but otherwise, if you need major stuff redrafted, you're going to have to pay for all this all over again.
Right.
And so letters were fantastically expensive if they were more than a page. That's why most were only a page. And people really they really said basically, hi, how are you? I'm fine. You know,
yeah.
They didn't say a lot more than that. But Paul's letters, these major, you know, meditations on God's word and on morality, yeah. And it's from an apostle, and he's dropping the equivalent of hundreds or thousands of dollars to send this to you.
Right. He knew that he was making something of importance.
Yeah.
And something maybe of permanence. Like, okay, they'll have this, and this will survive as instruction for them in
right.
the faith.
They're
yeah. Gonna, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, you're not pitching this in the trash or just sticking it on the shelf and forgetting it.
Right. And so the interesting thing, and you mentioned this to me before, and I had never known this until I kind of learned it from you, is that the likely collection of Paul's letters then is not a matter of going around to different churches and, oh, hey, did you get something from Paul? We're making a collection here.
Yeah, no.
That Paul himself kept a collection of his own letters.
Right. That was standard for any author with literary pretensions. Cicero did that. And the standard way that collections got formed is the author himself would do the first edition. He would select certain of his letters. He would then arrange them by some criterion.
Uh-huh.
And he also would probably revise them slightly.
Yeah.
And then he would publish the first collected edition of his letters. And then later on, he or his literary executors would produce a second expanded edition.
Mm-hmm.
And we can often tell when the second expanded edition begins because they'll stick the new letters at the end following the same organizing principle the original author established.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that in Paul's letters. So Paul's letters are arranged in reverse order of size, biggest first. Romans is the biggest, it's the first. Well, I should say we have kind of two sub-collections. One is his letters to churches, and one is his letters to individuals.
Okay.
They're both organized in this biggest first thing. So Romans is the biggest letter to a church, it goes first. First and Second Thessalonians are the smallest letters to churches, they go last. First Timothy is the longest to an individual, so it goes first. Philemon is the shortest, so it goes last.
Yeah.
But there's a hiccup in the process. As you're going through the letters, okay, Romans is the biggest, 1 Corinthians is the next biggest, 2 Corinthians also goes to that same church, Galatians is smaller, suddenly Ephesians is bigger. And then it starts shrinking again. And what that shows us is that the first edition of Paul's letters was Romans, 1 and 2 Corinthians, and Galatians.
Okay.
And then later, a second edition was prepared where additional letters, again, from Paul's archives, would have been included starting with Ephesians and then progressively getting smaller. And we can even show that as was normal in the ancient world for collected letter editions, Paul would have been the one to publish the first edition. And we can show that because Paul is martyred in AD 67.
Okay.
But if you correctly date the first letter of Clement of Rome, it looks like it was written in the first half of AD 70, just after the disastrous year of four emperors and before the destruction of the Jewish temple in August of 70. And because Clement refers to a sudden series of repeated calamities that have hit Rome.
Yeah.
That's the year of four emperors, because it was constant civil war during that year, or waves of successive civil wars. And then he also talks about the temple in Jerusalem as if it's still
functioning.
Okay. So it looks like it's first half of AD 70. Well, in First Clement, he's writing to the Corinthians, because they've had a schism in their church where certain people have been, the correct priests have been deposed.
Yeah.
And he's trying to get them to put them back in office. And he reminds the Corinthians of what Paul first wrote you. And then he quotes 1 Corinthians. Now, you might say, well, okay, so 1 Corinthians is the first letter to the Corinthians. No, it's not. If you read 1 Corinthians, Paul refers to an earlier letter that he had sent the Corinthians and that is not in the New Testament. And so there's another, there's actually more than one, but there's another earlier letter to the Corinthians, at least one.
It's gone.
But that, but the fact that Clement refers to 1 Corinthians as the first one indicates he was familiar with a collection of Paul's letters where it was first.
Yeah.
And so if you have a collection of Paul's letters already circulating by the first half of AD 70, that's so close to 67 when Paul's martyred that it's almost certain that the normal ancient practice was followed of the collected, the first edition of collected letters being issued by the author himself from his own archives.
Isn't that fascinating? So, yes. So, and then of course with the martyrdom of Paul, they would have become extremely valuable.
Right. I mean,
people would have, because they recognized Paul as an apostle, these would have been, there's no more of these coming. Mm-hmm. Let's get them.
And so one of his literary executors, probably either Luke or Timothy,
mm-hmm.
Because we know that they were both around at the time of Paul's death.
Yeah.
Went through the remaining archives and produced a new expanded edition that included the other Pauline epistles, in all likelihood, all of them.
So knowing a bit about ancient letters really helps us get an understanding of what, a much better understanding of what is actually happening in the composition yeah. and dispersal of these letters.
By the way, one little thing I wanted to mention it's kind of like, the more things change, the more they stay the same. You know how when you're late replying to someone, you always feel bad about that?
Yeah.
And kind of apologize and explain why you're so late replying. And
yeah.
Sometimes you would even get inquiries like, hey, why haven't you responded yet? Well, they did that in the ancient world too. They loved letters, getting letters so much that they would explain why they were so late in replying. And they would also say things like, write me back quickly. I want to know what's happening with you. And in one case, we actually have a letter. It was sent by an Egyptian where he includes blank papyrus so that the recipient will not have an excuse for not writing back quickly.
I'm going to try that with my kids. I have included a blank text. Please use it to send me a text back. Jimmy Akin, thanks very, very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on Catholic Answers Focus. We love it when you do. Please share it by either giving us a like or a share or a comment wherever you get your podcasts. And also, let your friends know they can join Radio Club. Just give us your email at CatholicAnswersLive.com. Scroll down to the bottom where it says Radio Club. Put your email in, and then you get a weekly alert when the new Focus episodes are
Foci.
Out. Foci are out. I am Cy Kellett, your host. We'll see you next time, God willing, on Catholic Answers Focus.